I've entitled this particular passage being, or this message, Being of the Light. There was a Bible study group that was discussing the unforeseen possibility of their sudden death. And the leader of the discussion said, "We will all die one day, and none of us really know when, but if we did, we would all do a better job of preparing ourselves for that inevitable event." Everybody shook their head in agreement with that comment. And then the leader said to the group, "What would you do if you knew you only had 4 weeks life remaining here on earth before your death, and then the great judgment day?" One gentleman in the group said, "I would go out into the community and minister the gospel to those who have not yet received Jesus as their Savior." "Very good," said the group leader, and all the group members agreed that that was a very good thing to do. One lady spoke up and said enthusiastically, "I would dedicate all my time to serving the Lord, my family and my church, and my fellow man with greater conviction." "Oh, that's wonderful," the group leader commented, and all the group agreed that would be a very good thing to do. One gentleman in the back, however, finally spoke up and said, "I would go to my mother-in-law's house for 4 weeks." Everyone was very puzzled by this answer, and finally the group leader asked the pending question, "Why your mother-in-law's home?" And he replied, "Because that would make it the longest 4 weeks of my life." Now, just to be clear, lest anyone get the wrong idea, I love my mother-in-law dearly, and I have spent days with her at her cabin in Spanish Ontario, and we got along famously. Although I must confess, I'm kind of playing with fire. One of the reasons she indulges my presence, I think, is occasionally I'm able to bring fresh fish back for our supper. That's something we both enjoy. However, those of you who know me know that I'm not very successful most days, so I may be overstaying my welcome at times. The reason I began with this little story is to offer to you a bit of a confession. This little story points to the whole subject of what scholars call the parousia, or end times. Some may even refer to it as the return of Jesus or return of Christ. Some biblical pastors and teachers just love this subject. They debate at length the minute details of the apocalyptic parts of the Bible, like Revelation and Daniel and even some of Jesus' words. I have seen biblical scholars pull out huge charts that supposedly explain in great detail the timing of the end of the world. Now, mostly these chart drawers draw their theology from a very old theology, which is largely debunked now, called dispensationalism. It refers to the idea that reality, as God made it, is divided into ages or dispensations. And if we discern when each dispensation begins and ends, we can ascertain the end of the world as we know it, to borrow from a Bare Naked Ladies song. However, I find this whole subject difficult and, frankly, unpleasant to wrestle with. My aversion to this subject likely has to go with the fact that for many years I've been bombarded with sermons, I've read books, I've been to debates, which often are full of speculations about the signs of the second coming that people have interpreted as signs. Some have even gone on to say just recently that this period of pandemic is a sign of the end of time. Or maybe the election south of the border is a sign. What most people do not understand is that the predictions of a timetable for the end of things has been around for thousands of years, even in the early church. I have heard in my lifetime many such predictions that the world is coming to an end. This despite Jesus being very clear in telling us that no one will know the day or the time for this event. But this acknowledgement by Jesus has not stopped people from writing many books on biblical prophecy. On the theological level and scholarly level, I find the whole thing very problematic. Many good people I've known over the years have taken their understanding of this subject from fanciful creations like the Left Behind series of books. The ideas in those books are about as legitimate as Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. It is a common pitfall for biblical scholars and others like myself to critique the apocalyptic worldview as being dualistic. And it is certainly wise to be on guard against habits of thought that pit one group of people against another in stereotypical fashion. And dualism is an important thing to understand. It is, in a nutshell, describing reality around us as black and white, dark and light, good versus evil. There's no gray areas in dualism. Many describe the need for these two things, these two sides, to remain in balance, lest the universe implode upon itself. In Eastern religion and philosophy, dualism is often referred to as the yin and yang. But dualism is a slippery slope because it's not a biblical position. It is actually paganism. However, too many of us find it easier to understand reality this way. This is certainly true of any thoughts of the end times or apocalyptic biblical passages. But in order to understand the apocalypticism that pervades the New Testament, including the preaching of Jesus, it is equally important to pay attention to the possible social context in which this dualism was a response. This whole genre of writing does not come out of a vacuum, but was instead instigated by historical events and experiences by those who wrote them and also by those who read these words. Apocalyptic literature is almost exclusively the product of persecution. This was certainly true in Daniel and Revelation. Daniel is a response to the persecution that Jews received at the hand of Antiochus IV of the Seleucid dynasty. And Revelation is a response to Roman persecution of the church. However, the situation in Thessalonica is a bit different. The problem Paul is addressing here in this passage today is a situation in which certain members of the Thessalonian assembly are failing to make a distinction between their ethical codes as people of God and their actions in the general society around them. This may not fully understand the church. They don't fully understand that the church is not just another social club, but rather a radical counter-cultural way of life that's grounded, of course, in the cross of Jesus. The contrasts are certainly sharply drawn in 1 Thessalonians 5, 1-11. Paul sounds dualistic, but he's not. He talks about light versus darkness, day versus night, wakefulness versus sleep, sobriety versus drunkenness, urgency versus a lack of urgency. Much of the vivid imagery in this passage, like the thief in the night and a woman in labor, the armor of God, is drawn from prophets, Old Testament prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Joel, and is echoed later in other passages of the New Testament text, such as, and also in documents like the Dead Sea Scrolls from Qumran. Such prophetic speech was meant to have a divine power to alter people's interpretation of the current events in which they were going through, and also to inform their moral decisions on how they're going to live. It actually sought to change what people see as they look around themselves and how they respond to it. One important theme in all of this is urgency. The urgency is focused on reference to a very important phrase in the scriptures, the day of the Lord. It is also suggested by the phrase that Paul uses called the times and the seasons. The reference to the urgency of time is really meant for us to see as a call to recognize the urgency of being prepared by living as God's children. The entry of God, the day of the Lord, the parousia, is inevitable, like labor pains, but indefinite, like the arrival of a thief in the night. Now, I really appreciate the power of the illustration of childbirth here. Once the baby is coming, it will eventually arrive. We may know the guess at the delivery date, but you just really never know when it's going to happen. And once the contractions start, it's doubtful a woman can say, well, gee, I've changed my mind. Paul's point here is that the people of God must be prepared at all times, like dutiful guards on watch. When we focus on the urgency of time, looking for signs of the end, we miss Paul's point and we miss Jesus' point too. Preparing for the end is not about watching a clock or a calendar, because, again, Jesus says we will never know when it's coming. It's all about being ready all the time, because God is already working among us, saving, preparing, extending grace to everyone. Another theme that comes up in this passage and other literature like it is one that can cause us to lose sleep because of the picture of God that emerges. And by extension, how that picture is used in sermons and teaching on the end times. Many people are leery of the image of God as a judge that runs through this passage. And given the judgmentalism that can go with religious fervor, they are right to be wary. You know of what I speak. It's that fire and brimstone type of stuff. It even extends to negative views of marginalized groups, painting them as outside of God's grace and subject to burn for eternity. But hold on a minute. What if we've got it wrong? And we've had it wrong all along. What if passages like this one from Paul were not about God's specific decision or even desire, as some people like to insinuate, to come in judgment? What if it comes from a different place? Such as the deep-seated Jewish understanding of the awesomeness and the terrifying power of God's sheer holiness. For example, the reason there's such an elaborate description of the consecration of priests for the temple in Leviticus 8 is to stress the means by which they were set apart and to be prepared to deal with holy things in the temple. On the negative side, there's that very strange story about the death of Uzzah after he simply reached out to steady the ark that was being drawn by a team of oxen and he was struck dead. It's just another witness to the potentially destructive power of holiness when someone comes before or in contact with it and is unprepared. Now, this is important to help us balance the thoughts of God's holiness with his ever-abiding love for us. What if, as the Jews believe, the day of the Lord, the parousia, will entail judgment, not because God chooses to be judgmental, but simply because of the full presence of his absolute holiness is destructive to whoever or whatever is unprepared to be in its proximity. Call it God's refining fire, if you will. Just being in God's presence can wreck us. Our unworthiness becomes so obvious in the presence of such purity and such holiness. There are precedents of this in the Old Testament, such as that very famous story of Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah finds himself in God's throne room and he's just overwhelmed by God's holiness. the seraph, which are a type of angelic being, are flying around the throne room, shouting back to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory." Do you remember how Isaiah responds to this? "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips." I also think there's a little bit of this in the Transfiguration story. The three disciples were overcome by the holiness of what they experience on that mount. I think this understanding of God is behind Paul's theological rationale of concern about the holiness of life among the communities in which he served. Paul is preparing his communities. Sometimes he actually sort of makes reference to the fact they are like a mini temple, to be in the presence of pure holiness on that longed for day. A longed for day that's sure to come when God is all in all. So naturally, the question then becomes, what then are the characteristics of holiness on a human level? What are the implications of the impending presence of a holy God coming into fullness in this world? In this particular passage, they consist of the strangely vulnerable armor of God, the community practices of encouragement, and the model of our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us. In his theological foundation, Paul has drawn a sharp distinction between you and them, between the children of light and those who are of night and of darkness. Literally, he says, sons of light, an image that depends for its force on the understanding of the role of sons in the Greco-Roman family who were to carry on the work of their fathers. Thus, the sons and daughters of light carry on the work of God in our communities, because God is the one who is light, and we should reflect that. And those who derive their life and darkness carry on their work of darkness. It's in their nature. Being a son, and again, I would add daughter here as well, of light, is a reference to what one does as an outward manifestation of whose we are. But in spite of the stark distinctions that Paul draws, the armor that the Thessalonians are advised to put on consists of the seemingly fragile, but actually very powerful, breastplate of faith and love and the helmet of hope of salvation. There is a difference here between being discerning towards others, which Paul does advocate, and opposing them with force, which Paul does not endorse. The action that Paul most explicitly commends is mutual encouragement, consolation, if you like. A repeated practical theme in not only 1 Thessalonians, but throughout his writing. What stands out forcefully is the building up of a community in Christ is, for Paul, evidence of the holiness of life. Holiness is not an individualistic endeavor, but instead it's a daily practice of building up the people around us. To be truly pursuing holiness, we need each other. Finally, as an image of holiness, Paul puts forward the model of Jesus, who died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, meaning alive or dead, we may live with him. This is an astonishing statement for several reasons. One is the assertion that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live with him. Having drawn the distinction so keenly between sleeping and waking and light and dark, Paul just gathers up the whole community of the baptized in this assurance of their salvation. The other interesting aspect of Paul's mention of Christ is less explicit, but it is a theme he returns to quite often in his teaching. The cross as a moral pattern. You can read about that in Philippians 2 if you like. And the stunning statement, I die every day, in 1 Corinthians 15. A holy community is one in which the participants are giving themselves away in the small currency of everyday acts for the common good. Now, when I think about this passage in the terms that I've outlined for you, I'm more at peace with this whole subject of the end time. The picture that emerges here of God is more beautiful and certainly more consistent with the character of God being love. In Paul's day, the people understood the awesome power of kings and emperors and their underlings in causing terror when they were brought before them. A sense of unworthiness when they came before the king may even in their hearts, that would occur in their hearts, would make their legs shake and their knees buckle. If you were summoned before the king, you would prepare yourself, if you could. You would seek not to offend. Paul is saying that when we meet God face to face, like Isaiah the prophet, his mere presence will undo us. Our knees will knock and we will shake from head to toe. God's holiness will drive us to despair over our unworthiness. But then the Son of God will enter that throne room. He will stand beside us and speak on our behalf. We may be unrighteous. We are unworthy. But Jesus, well, he's worthy. It is his righteousness that God will see, not ours. I'm also very heartened by Tony Campolo's approach when people would ask him about the second coming and ask him when he thought it might happen. And Campolo's usual response was a great one. He used to say that he was on the welcoming committee, not the program committee. Or how about a true story of the anxiety this subject can cause in many people? It was during the 1960 presidential campaign that John F. Kennedy often closed his speeches with the story of Colonel Davenport, who was the Speaker of the Connecticut House of Representatives. On May 19, 1780, the sky of Hartford darkened ominously, and some of the representatives, glancing out the windows, feared that the end was at hand. And quelling a clamor for immediate adjournment, Davenport rose and said this, "The day of judgment is either approaching or it is not. If it is not, there is no cause for adjournment. If it is, I choose to be found doing my duty. Therefore, I wish that candles be brought in so we can see." Rather than fearing what is to come, we are to be faithful until Christ returns. Instead of fearing the dark, we are to be lights as we watch and as we wait. And I can think of no better approach to this whole very difficult subject.